It's the NPR News Update for Wednesday, January 28. I'm Phil Picardi with the podcast. Coming up, family members say they tried to sound the alarm about the man who died Monday outside of the New Hope City Council. How does police training prepare cops for violence? The governor releases a budget plan. The Walker Sculpture Garden gets a facelift. And remembering Auschwitz 7 decades ago. First, Minneapolis public school officials have canceled classes at Southwest High School today because of an unspecified threat. Principal Bill Smith recorded a phone message to students, staff, and parents last night.
We received a credible threat to the school community. The Minneapolis Police Department is responding to this incident. The safety of students and staff is important to us, which is why we made the decision to close.
Smith did not specify the nature of the threat. He said cancellations include classes as well as community ed classes, athletic events, and all extracurriculars. All other Minneapolis schools were open today, and they expect Southwest High School to be open tomorrow. The man who was killed after opening fire outside a New Hope City Council meeting Monday had a long-running conflict with the city and its police officers. Family members say they worried Raymond Kometz was headed for trouble. Tim Nelson has the story.
68-year-old Ray Kometz worked for years at his small business in New Hope. His brother, who asked NPR News not to use his first name, said lately Kometz had started an alarming decline.
He was a landscaping contractor, and then when the recession come, he basically went out of business, and that's when he started getting these delusions or whatever about he was, you know, treated badly by the cities and the police department.
Court and city records show a long-running dispute between Kometz and the city of New Hope involving his home and business tucked into an industrial park on the south end of town. He battled the neighboring suburb of Crystal as well. In 2008, he threatened to run down a police officer there with a bulldozer when cops tried to stop him from demolishing a building he'd been banned from, according to an application for a restraining order filed by the city's deputy police chief last year. Court records say Kometz had been committed by a mental health court and spent time at facilities in St. Peter and Anoka. He also unsuccessfully sued New Hope Police in federal court after a confrontation in 2009. Last August, Kometz took his dispute before the New Hope City Council.
My name is Raymond Kometz. Did have a New Hope address for 40-some years.
He recited a rambling list of grievances against the city.
I got busted up by 5 of your policemen, shot, tased, and my wife got terrorized. My house got terrorized. They took 5 police departments in and terrorized my house and took everything right down to the money out of the safe for groceries.
Last night, during another city council meeting in New Hope, Kometz's affronts took a deadly turn.
Get down. Everybody get down.
4109 emergency. We have shots fired in our city hall. Start an ambulance on the reds. Start crime lab. And have another agency cover our calls while we get this sorted out.
That's audio from the cable TV broadcast of the council meeting, followed by a call for help from police as they traded fire with Kometz at New Hope City Hall. 2 officers were wounded in the exchange. Officials with North Memorial Medical Center said one of the officers, Joshua Earnessy, was listed in fair condition after the shooting. Authorities didn't release the condition of the other officer. Kometz's family said they'd feared he was bent on something dangerous. A police report says another of his brothers called Crystal Police last summer and said that Kometz wasn't taking his medications and that he had made threats about taking a gun to the police department to reclaim some property and that he, quote, probably wouldn't be back. His son Nathan told Care 11 TV that the family had grown alarmed.
The social worker that he had for 4 years, I called her and said, you know, you've got to do something, you know, this is going, he's getting to extremes where he's mad and something has to be done. And she said, I can't do anything, he's not my client anymore, blah, blah, blah. I said, well, something happens, this is on your hands because I called you and I don't know what else to do.
And last night at New Hope City Hall, something did happen. Kometz is the 3rd person shot to death in an encounter with Twin Cities Police in the last 2 weeks. The Hennepin County Sheriff's Office is investigating the incident. With reporting assistance from Brant Williams and Laura Ewan, Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Officers present for the shooting in New Hope know all too well how quickly an encounter can turn. Many departments provide psychological training and support to officers to help handle the stress involved in police work. Dr. Stephen Norton is a psychologist based in Rochester. He works with police departments, and he spoke with Kathy Werzer this morning.
Please explain to me, why is psychological support necessary for police?
Well, police officers experience a great deal of stress that's certainly different than the regular public or a normal type of job. The stress of just dealing with the daily challenges of working in police departments, and then certainly the stress of traumatic incidents like we saw yesterday in New Hope. All those can certainly add a lot of stress to law enforcement work.
So you mentioned day-to-day stress. This needs, I would presume you have to be hyper-vigilant.
Yes, that's correct. I think most police officers operate on a higher level of caution than the rest of us in society. They're always trying to watch for what problems may occur, try to remain aware, but also in control of the situation, control of their actions, and try to prevent any situations from escalating.
I would think that would have to be exhausting.
It can take a toll at times, that's true.
So, and then you add on, as you say, another layer here. You have critical incidents, say, like a shooting. How are officers trained to respond to such incidents?
Part of the training involves an awareness of the kind of hot and cold nature of law enforcement. For many law enforcement officers, the days become not necessarily routine, but predictable. They have the same type of work. They involve the same type of individuals that they deal with. It becomes fairly regular and not overly traumatic. Then, within a matter of seconds, the situation can go from relatively quiet and calm to threatening, dangerous, and become a very traumatic situation. That hot and cold nature of police work itself adds a lot of stress. And part of the training for law enforcement officers is just to be aware of that potential stress and then hopefully also encourage them to develop ways to manage that stress.
When you work with officers, doctor, what are the common symptoms that you see that are stress-related that you look at and you think, this can be a problem?
It somewhat depends on the cause of the stress. If it's a reaction to a traumatic incident, often you see officers who experience maybe some difficulty sleeping for the first few days. They may become even more hypervigilant. They may have some flashbacks to the incident. They may have a significant period of time where they're questioning if they could have done something different. The more common stress, or kind of the daily stress, sometimes you see an increase in difficulty sleeping, maybe an increase in physical symptoms. They catch colds easier, for example.
Given the high level of tension that officers work with day to day, do you see a lot of officer burnout?
That can certainly become a problem for many officers. At times, they start to question whether or not their actions really are making a difference. Unfortunately, at times, you deal with repeat offenders, so to speak. You continually are dealing with very unfortunate, very violent situations, for example, and just the repeated nature of that sometimes starts to question whether or not your actions actually make a difference. And that often is a sign of burnout in officers.
Interesting conversation, doctor. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I appreciate you having me.
Stephen Norton and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. Governor Dayton delivered a strong message to Minnesota State colleges and universities and to the Minneapolis Park Board in his budget plan. While Dayton's $42 billion budget increases funding for education, human services, and other areas, he says MinSCU and the Park Board have to do what he wants before they will get any more state money. Tom Scheck has more.
Governor Dayton is clearly making children a top priority in this year's budget. He's spending more on early childhood education, K-12 schools, and higher education, but not the Minnesota State Colleges and University System. Dayton said he's withholding any increase in funding until the chancellor and faculty resolve their differences over a plan for the future of the system.
We need a united MinSCU that brings the administrators and the faculty and all the other support staff together in common quest for a better future for MinSCU and for the students it serves. and that a continuation of this divide would be very detrimental to Minsku, to its campuses, to its reputation.
Minsku's administration and faculty issued a statement pledging cooperation. The two sides have been sparring for months over Chancellor Stephen Rosenstone's plan to overhaul the system. After a legislative committee hearing, Rosenstone declined to comment beyond the statement.
Statement is the statement.
But he's saying you guys got to resolve your differences.
There you go.
Why are you not talking about this?
We are. We made a statement to you, and we want to stand by that statement. So thank you.
Thank you.
Dayton said, however, that he's keeping $35 million in reserve in case the dispute is resolved soon. Minsku isn't the only group Dayton is targeting. He zeroed out state money for the Minneapolis Park Board. Dayton said he's not willing to commit nearly $3.8 million in state funds to the Park Board after the board hired consultants to look into different options regarding the Southwest Light Rail line between Eden Prairie and Minneapolis. Dayton said the Park Board is obstructing the process when other local governments have agreed on the Metropolitan Council's plan for the line.
But in my view, if they have all this additional money to throw around for consultants, then they don't need all the state money that's being allocated to them.
Minneapolis Park Board Chair Liz Walensky said she's disappointed with Dayton's action, but isn't willing to back off hiring consultants to study an alternative to the current plan.
The Met Council should have been doing this work, and we're having to take general fund money to do it out of our system, which really could be put to better use. But since we were elected to protect the park system, that's what we're doing.
Republican Senate Minority Leader David Hand said Dayton's approach to the Park Board is, quote, an interesting way to negotiate. Republicans criticized Dayton for spending too much but didn't offer a budget plan of their own. Republican House Speaker Kurt Dowd hinted that, unlike Dayton, House Republicans are likely to support more spending for nursing homes.
We know that Greater Minnesota really needs some solutions that are going to help them maintain the nursing homes in a way that really show their loved ones and our aging population that the respect that they deserve. So the governor does not put any new money into that, and that is a disappointment as well.
Dayton's budget also keeps funding flat for cities and counties. The governor said local governments saw huge increases in the last budget cycle. DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach agrees with the bulk of Dayton's budget, but suggested the Senate may dedicate some money to give nursing home workers a raise. As for local government aid, Bach says there's some concern that cities didn't hold the line on property tax hikes after getting an increase 2 years ago.
Clearly their job's made harder now. They're going to have to work pretty hard, I think, to get new money out of the legislature when the governor didn't have it in his budget.
Both the House and Senate say they'll release their budget plans after the next budget forecast is released in February. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Governor Dayton's new budget calls for more Department of Human Services funding to help cover Minsure expenses. Mark Sedeklik reports.
Dayton's budget recommends an additional $10.5 million for DHS to fund Minsure's ongoing IT development. Another $1.1 million would help finance Minsure's operational budget. Human Services Commissioner Lucinda Jessen says government-sponsored health plans account for a much bigger share of total enrollments than expected. That means more taxpayer funding for Minsure.
If Minsure had more private plan enrollments, the percentages would be different and the amount of costs borne by the public programs would be different.
Jessen says spending more on IT improvements is intended to, among other things, solve problems updating consumer accounts in the event of life changes, such as marriages and births. Mark Sedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News, St. Paul.
The Builders Association of the Twin Cities wants a state appeals court to halt enforcement of Minnesota's new residential fire sprinkler mandate. Here's Matt Sepik.
The mandate went into effect Saturday. It requires fire sprinklers in new homes 4,500 square feet and larger, including basements. The Builders Association says the mandate is expensive and will price many buyers out of the market. But Eden Prairie Fire Chief George Espenson says the costs are a small part of construction and a sprinkler system saves lives.
Once that sprinkler system's in there, then it virtually guarantees that the occupants of that structure will not die in a structure fire as long as the fire sprinkler system is operational and they have working smoke alarms.
The Builders Association is also challenging new energy efficiency rules in the building code. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The look of the Minneapolis Sculpture Garden would be transformed if a new design is approved by the Minneapolis Park Board and the Walker Arts Center. Last year, the state legislature appropriated $8.5 million to renovate the Sculpture Garden grounds, which opened in 1988. In addition, the Mississippi Watershed Management Organization is contributing $1.5 million to the project for the construction of a stormwater control system. Dana Murdoch is the project manager and an architect with the Minneapolis Park Board. She talked with Kathy.
Now, what do you want to accomplish with this renovation?
The things we do need to accomplish were identified mostly both by the grantors. First of all, the money from the state of Minnesota is direct in that we need to improve the drainage and irrigation, improve the hardscape infrastructure such as the granite paving and stairways and walkways and the plant materials and the trees, as well as improve the mechanicals of the conservatory. They are outdated and costing the park board a lot of money, and also physical accessibility as far as the toilet rooms and just general physical accessibility throughout the site.
Sounds like a lot. The conservatory that you're talking about, that has the big glass fish inside.
Yes.
What are you planning to do there specifically?
Now, all of the art in the Sculpture Garden, of course, is handled by the Walker Art Center. The Frank Gehry standing fish will be relocated from the Coles Conservatory in order to reimagine and think about the future of how that conservatory would be used. However, any formal announcement as to where it will go and all the rest of the art will be made by the Walker Art Center early this year.
You mentioned stormwater drain-off, which can be a problem. When it rains a lot, it can get pretty soggy in that garden. What are you thinking about when it comes to stormwater retention and mitigation?
Sure. The most northern portion of the current design shows a meadow that would be the lowest portion of the design, that when there would be heavy rainfall, you might see a little bit of that water collecting. We would be collecting that water and any of the other drainage on the site and incorporating it into a system that can really tell a story about water on the site and hopefully really incorporating into the pond for the Spoon Bridge and Cherry.
Was that site originally a wetland?
Yes.
That's what I was wondering.
Essentially a swamp.
Yeah, okay. So it's going to kind of revert back to that.
Yes.
In that area.
Yes, definitely. That's the basis of the idea for the design at the most northern portion of the garden.
Would there be any changes to the Spoon Bridge and Cherry? Folks love that sculpture, obviously.
Not the Spoon Bridge and Cherry, other than updating the pond itself and cleaning it up and hopefully bringing it back to some of the splendor of when it was originally installed. It will remain in its same location.
And the tall hedges just across from the Walker?
The tall hedges that wrap around the four rooms. A larger idea for the entire garden is to open it up and make it perhaps more visually connective from passers-by, whether they are pedestrians, bikers, or driving. So those tall hedges, which have gotten very tall, those arborvitae, the plan at this point is to take them out and replace them with a somewhat lower hedge that will open up that space a little better.
Now, would we expect to see some of the sculptures replaced? Might this be an opportunity for the Walker to add or subtract some new art?
Certainly. They are planning to temporarily remove most of the sculptures just in order to do the majority of the construction, and that most will be in storage, but others will be on short or long-term loan to other institutions in the Twin Cities. Now, again, similar to Standing Fish, these are things they are working on, and they will make a public announcement early in this year.
If this is approved, when might construction start?
Construction is planned to start as early as August of this year, and it should last about a year into fall of 2016. And the garden will be closed during that time.
Dana Murdoch, thank you.
Thank you very much.
70 years ago, Auschwitz, the Nazi concentration camp, was liberated. To mark the closing of the concentration camp complex where more than 1 million people died, the University of Minnesota is unveiling an unusual art project. Paintings and videos preserve the stories of individual Holocaust survivors who later settled in Minnesota. Peter Cox has that story.
Auschwitz survivor Dora Zaidenweber of Minneapolis is 91. She turned 21 just days before Auschwitz closed, but she was transferred to another camp. Even though she was reunited with her father, brothers, and husband after the war, the devastation of that time has not left her.
Losing the entire family, other than my immediate family, still weighs very hard on me.
Zaidenweber was one of 9 Minnesota Holocaust survivors whose likenesses were captured as part of the Portraying Memories Project. The University of Minnesota Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies commissioned Spanish painter Felix de la Concha. He presented his work last night at the Weizmann Art Museum. De la Concha works fast. Over 2 hours, he interviews his subjects as he paints. A video camera records the process.
I like this period of the life of the people when they have also this history on their faces, in a way. It's like a map. It's been marked on their own, their whole lives there.
Victor Vital grew up in Greece. His family hid from the Nazis, moving between mountain villages. He says they came close to dying of hunger. The 82-year-old loves the portrait painted of him, though it shows him recalling painful memories.
Besides painting the face, he somehow was able to express my feelings at that time. Look at there, my eyes, and generally the face, the way I look. And I could not smile telling him all those things that they happen.
Alejandro Baer is the director of the university's Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies. He says the portraits and video offer something that still photos and documentaries can't.
Well, this is a totally new approach, and I think it combines two elements that are of crucial value. On the one hand, the portrait, since a portrait is a homage, always it's honoring the person, and we're honoring here survivors. And at the same time, Felix de la Concha captures in video the very act of bearing witness.
But for Dora Zaidenweber, the project brought mixed feelings.
I am very much in favor of transferring memory. So in that respect, it's a very good project. But you have to understand that we are now actually limited to a very few remaining people. So that's sad that some of those stories are no longer available.
A daughter of Holocaust survivors, Joni Sussman of Minneapolis, knows many of the people in the portraits, as well as their families. Sussman is happy to see their memories preserved through the project.
We've lost so many survivors even in the last few years that these are really the last remnant. And I personally find it very poignant that today on the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, these survivors are here to tell the tale. It's remarkable.
Baer, the director of the Center of Holocaust and Genocide Studies, hopes the paintings and videos will become part of a permanent collection at a Twin Cities museum. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And that's the NPR News Update for Wednesday. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News Podcast. I'll be back tomorrow with Thursday News.